Tommy, how's the peeping? Tommy, how's the peeping?
This isn't playtime. This is serious business.
Well, the play must go on, I believe.
I'm always home. I'm on cool.
I've been thinking a lot about dying lately.
I'm trying to do good. That's that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of That's That, a Philip Seymour Hoffman retrospective podcast. My name is Timothy Mark Davis, and I'm your host. Today we are talking about The Talented Mr. Ripley, the 1999 crime drama thriller based on the novel by Patricia Highsmith. Written and directed by Anthony Minghella, no idea how to say that name, and starring Matt Damon, Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, Kate Blanchett, Jack Davenport, and the slimy socialite Philip Seymour Hoffman. I hope you took the time to watch the film on HBO Max or rented it, because I think it's just really impressive writing and storytelling, and is another excellent installment to the Foreseen Phil catalog that we get to explore on this podcast. My guest today is friend, collaborator, and filmmaker Kelly Ray Jordan. How are you doing today, Kelly?
I'm doing pretty good. Interested to dive into this film, which I only saw for the first time this year.
Me too. I only saw it for the first time yesterday. So,
whoa.
Yeah, this is one of those, like, years ago I was like, I'm just going to not watch some of his films so that I have them to watch later in life. And this was one of the ones that I just never watched. And so I'm new to this one as well, which is exciting.
It's a great one.
Yeah. So we're talking about The Talented Mr. Ripley, which features Philip Seymour Hoffman in his 23rd feature film as Freddie Miles, a slimy, aristocratic socialite and friend of Dickie Greenleaf, played by Jude Law. Here's the log line from IMDb. In late 1950s New York, Tom Ripley, a young underachiever, is sent to Italy to retrieve Dickie Greenleaf, a rich and spoiled millionaire playboy. But when the errand fails, Ripley takes extreme measures. And here's the logline from HBO Max. A penniless young man becomes intoxicated by the lush life in Italy and will do anything to hold on to it. Very, very different log lines. Kelly, what's your initial take on these? Do you think they describe the movie? Which one interests you? What do you think?
Wow. I think there's so much more to it than what either of these log lines tell, which of course is what log lines do, right?
Yeah.
I do want to say I feel like the first one fits a little bit more.
Mm.
But the second one is probably, as I read it again, I think it's a little bit more accurate, because this is ultimately who he becomes.
Yeah.
And it motivates his decisions in a very extreme way. So, yeah. Now that I think about it, I think that the first one more describes Dickie. The second one definitely hits Tom Ripley's character spot on.
Yeah, it's interesting. The first one gives you all the setting, New York, Italy, the 50s.
Yeah.
Rich millionaire playboys. Whereas the HBO Max one is like, it's just about the protagonist. Like,
yeah.
Here's what this guy is after. It's like a totally different approach to a sentence that sells a movie, I guess.
Yeah, I think I'm actually more drawn to the second one personally, just because it gives me enough without giving me everything. So I kind of want to know what's so intoxicating about this life. Who is he interacting with? Italy is already a beautiful place. How does he get there? Is he American? Is there it gives me so many more questions in the second one.
Yeah, and we'll do anything to hold on to it. It's like that could be
that
could go so many different directions, which is exciting for sure.
And I think that also that idea, something that's could be ultimately relatable to all of us, right? That desire for more.
Yeah.
whatever it may be. Yeah. Can ultimately, I think, is something that we can all connect with.
I'm sure we've all found ourselves doing things that we didn't think we'd do in order to get something that we want, you know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's like, it's just a very, very universal struggle, I think, is at the heart of this film, as dark and disturbing as it is at times.
For sure.
Yes.
Dark and disturbing for sure.
Yes, definitely. So as mentioned, the film was written and directed by Anthony Minghella. I'm just going to go with Minghella, whose other notable writing and directing credits include The English Patient, Cold Mountain, and Breaking and Entering. Cold Mountain was another film featuring our man Phil. It came out in 2003. It also starred Jude Law. Sadly, Minghella passed away suddenly of a hemorrhage in 2008 at the age of 54. But he's got, you know, English Patient won 9 Academy Awards. He received 4 Academy Award nominations during his career, personally.
Wow.
3 of them for writing and 1 of them for The English Patient for Best Director, which he actually won in 1996. So a lot of his work was adaptations. Cold Mountain, English Patient, Talented Mr. Ripley, all novel adaptations. And there's a really good interview with him and Charlie Rose where he kind of breaks down his process of how he adapts a novel. We'll actually play a couple of clips from it in today's episode, but I'll link that whole interview in the show notes as well, because I think for anyone who's looking at doing an adaptation, I think his kind of approach could be helpful. The film has an 83% on Rotten Tomatoes, if that matters to you. It received 5 Academy Award nominations for original score, costume design, art and set direction, adapted screenplay, and supporting actor for Jude Law. Wow. It had a budget of $40 million. It grossed nearly $130 million during its theatrical run. It was released on Christmas Day, 1999, so just had its 21-year release anniversary. That's not a word, but I'm making it up right now. The film started production on August 10th, 1998. It shot all throughout Italy. Most of it was shot in Italy, and those New York scenes were shot in New York. Production ended on December 7th, 1998. One other little piece of trivia that I found interesting was that after viewing this film, Tommy Wiseau, I don't know how to say his name, who wrote and directed and starred in The Room, the famous cult awful movie that The Disaster Artist was based on. After he saw this, he was so emotionally moved that he vowed to make a film just as, if not more, compelling. So The Talented Mr. Ripley really is some of the source material and inspiration for The Room. So any of you Tommy Wiseau fans out there or Disaster Artist fans, now you know, you have this film to thank for Tommy being inspired to write his own movie. Have you seen The Room or The Disaster Artist, Kelly?
I have seen neither of those films.
Yeah, that's fine. You don't need to get into it. It is an absurd sort of sub narrative of the film, of the Hollywood world. Do you know the story behind it at all?
Behind either of those two movies?
Yeah.
No.
I've never
even heard of them before.
Okay,
to be honest.
Good for you. So basically, the Room is considered the best worst movie ever made.
Oh, wow.
So it's like a truly terrible, terrible movie. The writing is awful. The plot makes no sense. The acting is so overwrought and cringy. It's become like a cult classic for being so bad. So like it has screenings in theaters all the time. The writer director guy is truly a bizarre Tommy Wiseau, a bizarre, bizarre human. And James Franco made a movie about the process of making that movie.
Okay.
A few years ago.
So that I've heard of.
Yeah.
I have heard of that.
Okay.
The making.
The Disaster Artist. Yeah.
Yes, I have. But I didn't understand it and it didn't interest me. So I kind of just moved past it.
Yeah,
but I do remember
enough.
The movie about the makings of
the
Room. So
the best worst movie ever made. It's
how
actually, I've never even seen The Room, but I found I knew the story of it, but I thought the Disaster Artist was hilarious, even not having seen The Room, because they like scene for scene, shot for shot, copy so many of the, they reenact so many of the scenes. It's really hilarious and crazy.
Okay. That's something to check out possibly or yeah, not for check sure. out.
I think not Disaster sure. Artist is on Prime if anyone wants to watch it. But again, if you're not into that, like, I'm going to laugh at this awful movie, it's probably not your cup of tea.
See, now I want to see it because if you're saying it's inspired by the talented Mr. Ripley, I know. I'm trying to connect the dots. So now I feel like I have to see it because it was such a great movie, The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure how that can inspire you to, but hey.
Well, if you're inspired by something, but you have no skills or talent or taste, but you still decide to make something, which is the Tommy Wiseau bizarre thing. He's just self-funded a $6 million movie. Nobody really knows how he did that. Wow. And it's so awful. But it's so bad that it's good. It's something. It is something.
Worst film ever. I'm
so yep. sorry. So moving back to The Talented Mr. Ripley, or as we can now call it, the source material for The Room. Kelly, what are your overall thoughts, feelings, and impressions of this film? Give me just the initial, what do you think? What do you feel?
It was so good. Yeah. I mean, I had heard about the movie for years, but it didn't interest me really. It just seemed like one of those, it's just another one of those type of saga, drama, you know, situations. But honestly, because of the pandemic, my husband and I were going through different movies. What should we watch? And that was one of the movies that popped up. Yeah. Like, let's watch this. And it was so riveting.
Yeah.
I mean, the acting was incredible. The story was incredible. The writers did a fantastic job. I mean, I really felt connected to every character. Mm. Loved some characters. Loved to hate some other characters. Hated to love some other characters.
Yes.
So a lot of mixed emotions, but it was such a great, great film. I think, again, Mr. Ripley, his character was so, you could relate to him in the sense that, man, he wants something better. He wants more for himself. Mm. But unfortunately, he was a psychopath. And so there's that part. But honestly, at the end of the movie, my husband and I were talking about it the other day. Was he always a psychopath? Mm. You know, and because in the beginning, you know, he takes this jacket and the jacket almost gives him like power in a sense. And I think he realizes that, oh, Prince, the name Princeton comes with all of this,
some privileges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because in the beginning, it really just happens by accident, you know, the circumstances. And then so to see that, oh, he manipulates this positive circumstance into more continuously more favorable things. It's just really interesting how we can take something that's good and ultimately, like, it can ultimately like destroy us. He really, so with that, the whole thing is like, was he always this way? How many other times did he try this? Did he try this before? Was this his first opportunity to really, was he that like enticed by the life that was being lived by the people around him, wealth and fame and love and all of these things? Or was that always just something inside of him that the right circumstance pulled it out of him?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that is something where the movie kind of starts out in a sprint. It's a long movie. I was like 2 hours and 20 minutes, but like immediately we are kind of put in this guy is pretending to be someone who he's not. Like, that is the first scene. Yeah. He's already doing this thing on a small scale in order to make a buck or whatever. And then immediately, Herbert Greenleaf, Dickie Greenleaf's dad is like, hey, go retrieve my son. And that's a question I had too, is like, so he gets asked that. I don't think he's thinking then, I'm going to go and kill this guy and assume his identity. And everyone knows that we don't do spoil. Yeah. Everything's a spoiler alert on this podcast. So if you haven't seen the film, sorry, don't listen to this podcast if you haven't seen the film. But it doesn't feel like that is his plan from the beginning, but it does feel like his decisions to kill these people make sense. And I think that's part of the brilliance of the storytelling, the writing, the acting, is like somehow we believe that this guy has this inside of him, right? Even though like he never lays out a plan to do that, but it just feels like believable. I don't know.
Yeah. Without hesitation, he has to keep up the ruse. So he's like, you know, whatever it takes.
Yeah, it hits that point where it gets too deep. It's like,
exactly. There's no turning back. Yep. And we know Gwyneth Paltrow, she's gonna have to die at some point. You know, she's at the end of the movie, you're like, oh dang, it's over for her. She's not gonna make it out alive. But I think, you know, just in thinking about him being penniless, obviously he was very talented as a, you know, on the piano. He was incredible.
Yeah. You know?
But obviously poor. And so I think this desire for more than what life had already handed to him is a temptation, because, you know, go to Italy, I'll take care of you. I just need you to bring this guy back. I mean, I'm not going to lie.
That's an offer.
You know, it's hey, it's an offer, free vacation, opportunity to experience something new. But unfortunately, it was built on a lie at the outset. And so there was always going to be, how do I, you know, fix this situation? I think it's a scene on the beach where he's, you know, confronted by one of the people. And he's like, actually, no, it might have been Jude Law's character. Probably should have watched it again. and he's like, how come I don't know, you know, how come I don't know you? I don't remember you. And he's like, trying to, you know, he was so smooth with his lies, which is why I feel like he was already a liar. You know, he was already someone who was just, it was easy for him. We never saw him really struggle to kill people or lie or, you know. So, yeah, it's just, it was a part of who he was already, just the perfect circumstances for him to really unveil.
And I think about, you talk about the lying just being kind of second nature to him. I think there's a parallel connection there to this repressed sexuality, 1950s, like his whole romantic life has had to be a lie and is a lie for parts of the movie. And that's adding another complication to his relationship with Dickie, obviously, and his relationship with, what's his name? Peter Smith Kingsley, the Jack Davenport character. Mm-hmm. It's like he's, you know, if someone was gay in the 1950s, it's like half their life is a lie. And so he's just like building on that skill set that he's already mastered in a way. Obviously taking it to levels and degrees that are beyond the average person. And it's interesting too with like the, you know, can copy someone's signature, can copy someone's voice.
Yeah.
You know, just like those weird talents that were built in from the beginning of his character. It's like, talented Mr. Ripley, right? It's
for
like,
sure.
What a weird set of talents, but effective for the life he starts leading.
Exactly. And obviously he did have to hone these talents. So it always makes me think about the life before we encounter him.
Yeah.
But I think the most heartbreaking part of the movie for me, in regards to sexuality, is this person who actually loves him and kind of gives him the opportunity to be more of himself.
Yeah.
He kills him. And that part, I'm not going to lie, I think I like teared up in that moment. I'm like, he's going to die. I just know it. Why is he going to kill him?
Yep. That was, you know, it was like, it was so interesting. This film did such a good job of, as soon as they went out on that boat, I was like, somebody's going to die on this boat. And as soon as, as Freddy, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, was talking to the maid, I was like, okay, he's dead. Like, he's going to go back up and he's dead. Yeah. And as soon as at the end of the film, Tom Ripley goes back into the cabin, and I think it was when he was like, don't turn around, you know, stay in your stomach and tell me good things about Tom Ripley. I'm like, okay, he's dead. And that's how the movie's going to end. This guy is going to die. Like, you felt that things were coming, but it wasn't obvious. It wasn't obvious in the filmmaking, but like, you just, all of a sudden, I just felt so tense and afraid for these other characters.
Agreed.
But yeah.
Yeah. That was the worst one for me, which was, just how it all went down. I mean, you could tell this guy really cared about him, saw him for his, you know, his flaws, and still really, I wouldn't say loved him. And the way that he
was trying to love him. Yeah.
And I think in that moment too, we see Mr. Ripley, Tom.
Yeah.
Really being, crossing over.
Yeah.
Even further. Yep. You know, this is someone who's helping you to be free, who's and you are going to kill him. That, to me, it was like, oh, obviously he had already killed, you know, someone, but the point of no return is that, okay, this is really the darkness of Tom, because he's really trying to, like, you know, tell me some good things about myself, you know, and it's like,
that's where I loved, I loved Matt Damon's performance in this. It was very, very mysterious performance, but also it just like made sense for the movie and the character. I think he does communicate this deep struggle in that, like, I'm going to kill you, but I also love you, or love you as much as I could love someone. Ooh. And the psychotic thing, like you said, is the, rather than having a breakdown and confessing and giving up this life, it's like, it is more important for me to maintain the false identity, maintain the person who I'm not, than to be accepted and loved by the person who's right in front of me.
Yeah. Intense.
Yes. Yes. Very intense. So let's talk about, I'm going to play a scene really quick. I'm going to play the piano scene, which is Freddie Miles, Philip Seymour Hoffman's kind of biggest scene in the film. I'm going to play a portion of that scene, and then we'll jump into the Hoffman performance.
Gotcha.
It's a new piano. Probably shouldn't.
Did this place come furnished? Like, it doesn't look like Dickie. It's really horrible, isn't it? It's so, bourgeois.
Oh, that's a, you should watch that. Excuse me.
You know, in fact, the only thing that looks like Dickie is you.
Hardly.
Have you done something to your hair?
Is there something you'd like to say, Freddy?
What?
Do you have something you'd like to say?
I think I'm saying it. Something's going on. Either he's converted to Christianity, or to something else.
Well, I would suggest you ask Dickie that yourself. Altella's is on Della Croce, just off the Corso.
Is it on Della Croce, just off the Corso? You're a quick study, aren't you? The last time you didn't know your ass from your elbow, now you're giving me directions. Oh, that's not fair. You probably do know your ass from your elbow. I'll see you.
Great music in this film, too.
Yeah. Ooh. Oh, for sure. In that moment, I just remember, okay, this dissonance. Yes. Something's about to go down.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. So give me your, I mean, I've certainly got my thoughts, but what are your thoughts on the Hoffman performance? What stood out to you? You know, he's got these four scenes. We meet him on the boat, at the record store, and then this is sort of his biggest scene in the film with Matt Damon up in the room. What stood out to you with his performance?
Not gonna lie, when he first hopped on the scene, I was very annoyed by his character.
Oh yeah. He is so annoying.
Oh, he's just like a slime ball in a sense. Yeah, I think he did a great job of playing a slime ball, honestly. Mm-hmm. But I think this was probably one of the other turning points where I realized, oh, well, not this scene in particular, but the scene I think before this one, you realize, oh, he actually really does, you know, he's a good friend to Dickie, you know? And yep. So I think that was like the turning point for me. All right, maybe he's not that. Oh, man, I'm going to feel bad if he dies. Like that's, right. That's I kind of got to that point. Like, oh, man, if he dies, I'm going to feel really bad about this. But I thought his acting was stellar. Just enough, you know, but not too much. I think for me, he played this role of like, I'm trying to put the words together. I thought the reveal was going to happen in this moment. So I had so much anticipation. Mm. Like, it was just like, is he going to say it? 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 So I really appreciated this scene, the intensity. Mm-hmm. And you could see some of the Tom starting to crack a little bit. And so I'm glad that moment did happen. We could see, all right, as well thought out as Tom seems to be, he really doesn't completely know what to do next. Yeah. Other than kill, obviously, which is his you know, his inclination. Last resort, but, his last resort.
But a resort he's willing to.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. So I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman did a fantastic job as this character. He's a character that I hated and then I loved at the end. It's like, damn, I don't want this man to die, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But he was definitely a slimy person to me. And I kind of struggled trying to figure out the relationship between him and Dickie. But he really did seem like he had Dickie's back to the end.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. Right. To both their ends. Yeah. Yeah. I think that first thing I want to say is like, we always play the audio on this podcast of different Hoffman scenes. This performance particularly was so physical. Like I was just thinking of the piano part, you know, you're in the audio, you're just hearing these piano things. You can go search Talented Mr. Ripley piano scene. I'll put it in the show notes too. But like he's doing this thing with his hand.
Yes.
It's like this physicality and the way he carries himself. And when he first gets out of the car, when he's first introduced and he like jumps out and he's walking across the street and he's got that signature line. It's very crude. There's such a physicality to this performance that I think, can't do justice in the audio.
I agree.
He's doing with his hands, how he's holding his body, his voice. It's just like, such a masterclass in physical acting.
You're absolutely right. And I that was one of the things I noticed about that character too, that he was a very distinct person.
Yeah.
You know, in every way, his movements, you know, how he spoke. And the things that he said.
Yeah. How's the peeping?
Yeah. He seemed like he was the most real. Yeah. The most authentic person.
Yeah. And not just like, I'm a beautiful Hollywood actor here to deliver a performance.
Right, exactly. But even the character himself was the most authentic, literally being himself. Tom was faking. Dickie was faking. Gwyneth's character was faking, you know, because she knew what Dickie was doing, you know.
Yep.
So they were all kind of faked. So to me, he was the most authentic character.
There's no pretense there.
Right.
No, that's a really good point. Yeah. And I think that's sort of the amazing, I mean, and you mentioned it already, but that was something that amazed me by the character and the performance and the writing of the character. You know, when you've got these supporting roles who are just in a few scenes and they have their, we talked about that a ton in the last episode, the Red Dragon episode. Played a clip of Hoffman talking about, you know, how does he think about these small roles? How does he, you know, and the line was, what will the story be missing if this character is not here? And then I fill in the gap. And that's sort of what I play towards as the actor. That ability to, we meet this person and we're like, ugh, you know, it's this person is just kind of exacerbating the worst parts about Dickie, the flakiness, the social climbing, the, you know, we're rich and lush and we can do whatever we want and there's no consequence and anything that I set my eyes on is going to be mine. He plays that authentically. You know, he doesn't try to not be that. He embraces that, which I think is more respectful than being that way and lying about it.
Right.
But then he does make this shift of, now I'm the concerned friend.
Right.
You know, I smell something fishy. I'm going to follow up on this. Really putting the pressure on Tom in that piano scene. And I think from the storytelling standpoint, we're supposed to feel this conflict of, I don't like this character. So some people might be like, oh, well, good that he's dead. And some people might be on that side of like, well, he was looking out for his friend, or we all might be like, feel this gray area of like, you know, this classist jerk, you know, he deserves to die. But at the same time, it's like, no, he makes that change to being the concerned friend, to being an advocate for someone who was murdered. And I think that just it complicates his character. You know, I'm not, you know, I don't know. I don't even know where I fall necessarily. I mean, I was rooting for him in this scene. You know, I'm like, yes, find it, figure it out, make it happen. But I'm still like, oh, you're a slime ball and I don't like you. And I think that, you know, being able to write a character who's only in four scenes and can have that sort of complexity, moral complexity, but then to act it as well and it be believable in each of the scenes. So impressive.
The consistency of character. I mean, obviously he's an incredible actor. I don't want to say underrated just because I mean, I haven't seen a lot of his films. But from what I have seen, I can appreciate him as an actor. And I think it's really inspiring to see him take this, you know, supporting role and give you all the feelings about it.
Yeah.
You know?
So
I can appreciate that. I think he did. I mean, the entire cast was incredible. But I definitely appreciate just like how you're saying, the role that he played, you know, you hate him, you love him, you want him to die, you're happy he's dead, you know, all those complexities. I think obviously the character was well written, but I think he did a great job of making us feel those things.
Yeah, definitely.
Hoffman is great. He is amazing. He's you know, it's very funny. I was looking at a tape the other day of the actors talking about the film for this sort of electronic press kit that they make. And you go from Gwyneth, who's very sort of considered and talking, and Matt is talking, and Kate Blanchett is very smart, and Jude, and they're all very intelligent, articulate group of people. And then suddenly it cuts to Phil, and there's this guy going, and Freddie is the guy, he's the man. And it's like you've suddenly flipped channels and you're watching a completely different, he's an amazing, amazing actor. And I think he has exploded this year into movies, and people have suddenly worked out what a great national resource he is for movies.
So I love that clip because it gives a little context. In 1999, Magnolia came out, which is a Paul Thomas Anderson film that Hoffman has a great role in. Flawless came out, which is when he plays the character in drag with Robert De Niro. And this film came out, and they all sort of came out around the same time. And it was this post Boogie Nights, like now he's doing a you know, Talented Mr. Ripley's a big studio film, Miramax. Is behind it, and he's in this sort of new echelon of talent and resource as an actor from the Hollywood perspective. And I think his career really took a leap from supporting character in a auteur filmmaker to, oh, this guy can bring something to so many projects that is just going to make the whole movie better. Even if it is a few scenes, even if it is a lead, the sort of late 90s tipping point. And the thing I love about Phil's career is that, you know, while he was doing this, he was still involved in New York theater. He still did independent films. He still went back and worked with people who had been good to him. He still took a ton of supporting roles after this, even though this sort of launched him to a more public notoriety. He always stayed true to the stories that interested him as an actor, no matter what the size of his role was. And I never really thought of 99 as that flashpoint, at least in terms of the Hollywood scene. But after digging in on this film and realizing that this and Magnolia and Flawless were all coming out at the same time, that there was a lot of buzz about him. And these, you know, Magnolia and this film had Oscar buzz. And so he was doing more interviews and just out there on the scene, but never losing the heart of who he was as an artist, which is, I just got to remind myself of that every day. It's such an inspiration to me as an artist as well.
It's beautiful. It's beautifully said, Tim.
Yeah, no, you don't have to respond or add to it. It's fine.
No, it's perfect. I mean, it's perfect just the way it is. I think this movie and even more so this conversation is, you know, I do want to check out Capote and some of these other films that he was in to just see him act and transform these characters to more than just people on a page, but you know, humanize them, even the worst characters of all. So I'm excited to go check out some more of his work.
Well, you're not going to get a higher recommendation from me that is than me. No one will recommend him higher than me. That's what I'm trying to say.
I understand.
Yes. So the other thing about this film, and I'm going to play a clip from the director with back in that same Charlie Rose interview. This film is truly tragic and complex on sort of a meaning level. And I wanted to address that, talk about that. I know you said you and Samantha and I watched it together too. Last night, you said you and Tyler have been talking about it. So I want to hear from the director a little bit, sort of what he was getting at, and then talk a little bit about what we took from the film, what we thought the filmmaker was trying to say.
I wanted to make a cautionary tale, a kind of philosophical story wrapped up in the suspense vehicle. And
a cautionary meaning what?
Well, there's something to think about in this film. It's about, you know, the film asks the question whether it's better to be a fake somebody than a real
movie. Line that he just said there in the trailer.
Which I think is more prescient now than perhaps it was in the 50s, this sense that I feel we're bombarded in the media by images of that demand that we give up on ourselves in some way, that we feel badly about who we essentially are, that we're told that we should change our hair, change our bodies, change our lifestyle, change our couches, change our cars, change everything about ourselves, was essentially what we are is not good enough. And I think there's a moment in the course of growing up, particularly, which is where you realize that the essential business of being a human being is to be alone, and that the essential yearning of a human being is not to be alone. And how we, in some ways, make sense of those two perceptions defines us. And one of the ways that people do, and perhaps I've done in my life, is to say, well, if I hide who I essentially am, if I keep that a secret and aspire to be somebody else, perhaps people will find it easier to accept me. And at the heart of Ripley, I think there's somebody who's hiding and giving up on who he is in order to be accepted by a world he'd like to belong to. So I think that's something which is common to many people, I think, not just to him and me.
So takeaways, thoughts on what the filmmaker, on what Minghella just said, thoughts on, you know, you've been marinated on this film for a while now. What are you taking away from it?
Oh, I think it's very interesting what the director has said. And I think, you know, the challenge for me is, you know, I think of that quote, if people show you who they are, believe them. I just don't know that. The struggle for me is, I guess, is Tom actually showing us who he is? A schemer, a deceiver, a liar, a murderer. And is that okay? And then I wonder, you know, if he had, you know, been able to live life without the Princeton jacket or any of these things, would he be the same guy? That's where I'm kind of torn, because it's like, is it the circumstances that makes the man, or is it the man who grabs hold of the circumstances? So that's where I'm kind of like, I don't know, but I understand like the allure of wanting something better for yourself by any means necessary, trying to achieve that. But I can hear what the director is saying in the sense that, you know, Tom did want a sense of belonging. He did want to be known, to be seen as something other than a broke joke, you know. But I think he could have carved that out in a different way that didn't involve, because the thing about being yourself, like being yourself is great. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it should be where we all are. But I do have to consider the people around me too. Him being himself as he was caused people to die in cold blood. So I guess I'm just trying to ruminate and really ponder on, you know, the like reality of being yourself, but the also acknowledging who you are, like the worst parts of yourself and the best parts of yourself. And sometimes the worst parts of yourself could be selfish, could be deceitful, could be. And I, for myself, I don't want that to stick around. I could say like, love me as I am, but I hurt you all the time.
Yeah. What if you're awful and a jerk? And
you know, so there, so there's that, but I understand where the director is coming from though.
Yeah. It does seem like this is, I mean, this sort of, question that you're raising is something that we're dealing with culturally right now in a very intense way, where it's who, this is probably like a crude way of putting it, but who merits our empathy and who merits our judgment and consequences? And is it different? Is it different for people on the receiving end? You know, I'm not sure that there is sort of a golden rule that's, you know, you talked about, does the man make the circumstances or do the circumstances make the man? It's probably different person to person. And similarly, it's probably different in terms of what we can or even should give to another character. You know, so I say character as in like fiction, but I mean another person. You know, someone could watch this film and feel deeply, deeply empathetic for Tom Ripley because of the sexual repression and being in that time period and the class struggle, and you know, be really moved to feel for him and feel broken for him. In spite of his worst deeds. And then someone else could watch that film and say, no, this man needs to be brought to justice. He's a terror on society. He's psychotic. He's murdering people. And I think everyone would think that that is true, right? It's like, this person needs to be brought to justice. But the manner in which that justice is administered, or how we think about, feel about, talk about the person in the midst of that process, I think is a question that all of us are wrestling with right now as we see people who we deeply disagree with. I actually just having this conversation on my Facebook page, which I would not recommend to have these types of conversations on Facebook, but I found myself in one and sometimes I can't help myself, but it's like, I have these strong beliefs about certain things. And oftentimes those beliefs lead me towards having negative feelings about certain individuals, certain groups of people, certain voting blocks, you know, whatever identity you want to insert or group identity you want to insert. And so what am I supposed to do with those negative feelings? How do I process them? How do I work them out? How do I make them constructive rather than destructive? I think part of that, everyone has to sort of set boundaries and say, you know, I'm just not going to engage with this group of people. I think some people are going to set different boundaries. But it is, it is kind of messy. And it's interesting when, you know, this movie comes out in 1999 and it's like a cautionary tale of, hey, if you lie and you repress and you are not yourself, it's going to lead you to a place you don't want to go. It's going to distance you from yourself even further. And this is a cautionary tale against that. But I think 20 years later, we also have a societal urge for, yeah, but what about the victims? You know, it's like we get that, like, this was Tom's story and he is experiencing so much pain in the midst of these decisions. And I do think it's important to understand the villains, so to speak, and to be able to empathize with them. But what about the victims? I don't know. I'm sort of just rambling now, but
no,
I think we're wrestling around this question, right?
Yeah. And I think I do understand your point. And I do think that Tom, obviously at the end of the movie, he's not only, you know, strung up other people, but he's strung up himself. You know, yeah. he's now resigned to a life of just cover up and,
yep.
You know, and so I mean, honestly, I'm not going to lie. He's one of the lives that I mourned also in this film, because, you know, there's not an escape now for the life that he's chosen for himself.
Different kind of death. He forsook his humanity.
Yeah, ultimately. Yeah. But I do think that in terms of today, yes, we are very concerned, I think, about the victim, and rightfully so, you know. But I guess he's, in a sense, a victim too.
He is.
And so, you know, there's that, but it is so many turns. He had the opportunity to, like, and that's too, like, in my mind wrestling, like, there's so many moments where you could have just said, you know, no.
Right.
Or acted differently, you know, and like he has to, I don't want to say he has to pay for that, but he's responsible for every decision that he makes, just like we all are. Mm-hmm. No matter what happened in my childhood, you know, I can't take that with me my entire life and say, well, these are just, it's not an excuse to just, but I understand it. I do understand it, but it can't be an excuse for, you know, the rest of my life. But I feel bad for the character. I not even the character, but the man itself, because there are people who in life right now are making decisions that they feel like they have to in order to maintain. I mean, celebrities, regular people, drug dealers, you know, we're like myself, like we're all making these decisions. But I think, the film is a great film, and I'm glad that it is raising all these questions about humanity. How do we interact with each other? What lengths would we do to, you know, what lengths would we go to give ourselves a sense of like normalcy, even assuming an identity that he thinks is actually better than who he is.
Yeah.
You know, like that too, like the moment he puts on the Princeton jacket, I think his posture might have even changed in putting that jacket on. It's like, you as you are is not good enough.
Right.
You have to be someone else. And that comes with school status, wealth, skin color. There are people who lighten their skins, you know, lighten their skin right now because their association of acceptance is based on, you know, being of a lighter complexion.
Yeah.
So I think
based on white supremacy.
Based on white supremacy. I'm glad you said it. So
I'll say it.
um, So there's that too. And definitely self-acceptance, I think, would have helped him too. Okay, you're penniless now, but keep continuing to pursue, yourself, live as yourself. And that could have, I mean, obviously this is all fiction,
it's fiction, but where my brain, where my brain was going is like, if a 2-hour and 20-minute movie can kind of push us into the deep end of moral complexity in terms of how do we both be just and be, truth and love, right? How do we have both? It's like so much of our communication culturally now is not rooted in nuance or complexity or trying to bring these contradictory things together in order to grasp the full expanse of someone's humanity. Mm. And it's more just sort of blind exaltation in terms of sort of American celebrity culture where people are just put up on a pedestal for their talent or the way they look or whatever it may be. And in the same way, this blind writing off or canceling of people for a misdeed.
And right.
Neither of those things capture someone's life or capture the complexity of why they got to the place they did that is a great place of influence, or why they made that decision that harmed other people and ended their career or whatever it may be. It's like we gotta figure out a way to either like do the hard work of digging deeper into some of these things, which probably means many of us just need to have less opinions about everything. It's like if you don't know something, just it's okay to be like, I don't know, and I'm not gonna have like a strong opinion on that person or that issue or that hot topic of the day. I don't know, maybe it's like a stay in your lane trivializes it, but it's like do the work and the research and the digging to get the whole picture while still knowing that you could never have the whole picture of a human life. You can't even get the whole picture of our own life. We're a mystery to ourselves half the time. But like save the hot takes because they're not, positive or negative. They're not going to represent the truth in its wholeness.
Agreed. I think that was actually really well said. And yeah, sometimes we do just need to just zip it. Honestly, I mean, even for myself too, I'm like, I have to remind myself, you know what? Just zip it because you don't know. There's no way to mark someone's life. And I think that, again, we don't know the moment before Tom hopped on the scene and got the jacket. So, we don't know his experience or after, he could have turned everything around, but that's not really the point. I think the point is just we're seeing this person as he is, but we also can see ourselves. I mean, what am I doing in my life? Am I being Tom, in the sense that not killing, not the killing of people,
but metaphorically, how
right,
are
exactly, and how can I undo or not make the decisions that he's made? Because I won't lie, there's so many goals that I have in my mind, and much like you said, reminding yourself of why you do what you do and reminding yourself of the work that you want to do. And and that coming from a pure place within you, within yourself, because you know who you are and what you stand for and what work you want to create and how you want to show up in the world. And I think, knowing yourself, being rooted in who you are is very much a part of that. So I know I'm not going to accept this or that because I understand who I am. I'm not just going to accept whatever's thrown my way, what are the opportunities? Because there are going to be opportunities that come. They have a lot of dollar signs attached to it. They have come. Circumstances where I'm like, no, this is actually not in my lane. And I think for us as creative people, that's things that are going to happen. Like, you produce this, create this, be a part of this, and it has nothing to do with who we want to be and how we want to show up in the world as people. But we can compromise that, you know, and end up being, you know, going the route of, I don't want to say going the route of town, but, you know.
Well, serving someone else's life. Right. Serving someone else's vision. You know, it's certain that there's a parallel there to he's trying to live someone else's life. It's like, that's not your life.
Yeah. And it's hard to keep up with. And I think that's why there's breakdowns, because it's like, you know, you feel pressure to be and do a specific thing. Like, you know, you're looking over your shoulder, you know, I've got to dye my hair. Like, I've got to, you know, it's too much, and it can be overwhelming. I know it's experiencing that in my own life, where I felt like everyone was kind of pressuring me to fit this particular mold. And I'm like, that's not who I am. And so I'm, in a sense, kind of broken free, as you see from all these pictures or whatever. But broken
the glam.
Free.
It's beautiful. The glam. I love it.
Thank you. But breaking free from that, like, you know, I'm not here to do what you expect of me. Like, I have my own identity. You know, of course, for me, it's like more of a, you know, God-centered like type of thing. But also, like, I know who I am. And so that means I'm not going to settle for what you think I'm supposed to be, and allow that pressure to make me become someone that I'm not, even that I would even be ashamed of saying that I am. So, yeah.
Amen to that. You as a filmmaker, storyteller, writer, actor, director, you know, you're a little bit like me, where you like to do all the things and, you know, maybe be in control. I'm not putting that on you, but I know for me, that's
there's that.
Yeah, for sure. What inspires you to create, or what are you thinking about lately in terms of projects and creating the stories you want to tell? But maybe just start with what inspires you to create.
Whew. Creative inspiration. There's so many factors. But I would say that, you know, my faith is a big part of that, but also, how do we interact with the world? I think most of the projects that I've worked on and that I desire to work on are things that shift the narrative. You know, we have always seen specific stories being told. There's Hollywood produces kind of the same type of thing all the time. And I think my mind is always going, well, it would be great if we saw a story about, you know, that would allow people to think differently about this people group or, you know, this age group. So
you mean movies with a bunch of rich white people?
Right.
Like the one we just watched. You don't want any more of those? What?
No, you know, and they're great. They're great. But I think, you know, being a black female creative, like, there's a lot of intersectionality that kind of happens there. And so I'm always asking questions about how black people are portrayed on screen, and black stories not just being traumatic but joyful, and really detailing like the complexities of being human, because that's what black people are, or human. So I'm always thinking of that, and I'm always thinking about, you know, how women are being portrayed, black women, and we're not just placed in like these caricatures, but really allowed to explore the depth and breadth of who we are. So those are things that are inspirational to me, flipping the script in a sense, you know, looking at our world in a deeper way, looking at humanity in a deeper way, examining my own biases so that I can you know, create or be a part of stories that tear those things down. Those are the things that really interest me, the things that I really write about. Of course, I love Black love. I love love stories. I love, love, love them. But yeah, we don't have enough of them that are deep, rooted, or that are even, you know, not, I can't get away from the word caricature, because that's just all I see. Yeah. It's very frustrating. Yeah. But those are some of the things that just inspire me.
No, I love that. And I love your life mission. I love what you're here to do. And I am so supportive and excited for you.
Oh, I appreciate it. And I appreciate the support. As I really appreciate the support.
Oh, totally.
And looking forward to doing more and telling stories that ultimately change the world, change people's perceptions of what they think is true, or what they've been told, what they've seen on the screen, that have created this stereotype, this bias in their mind that's not actually rooted in reality.
Yeah.
So that's something that I
stories that are transformative, one could say.
Interesting that she bring up that word transformative. Yes, but transformative for sure.
Definitely.
For sure.
Well, I want to close, because I think we're at a good stopping point. I want to close with a quote from Matt Damon, actually, talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman. And then we'll jump into the end credits, and you know, you can we'll have you plug your stuff and all that good stuff. So this is Matt Damon, pretty soon after Philip Seymour Hoffman died back in 2014. He was on the interview circuit for the Monuments Men George Clooney film at the time. Wow. And he was asked about Hoffman's death, and here's what he said. He was the best. He was incredible. He was a very special guy and one of the best actors to ever live, I think. And that scene I did with him in that movie was the best time I think I've ever had. Just in terms of being with someone who was so locked in, it was just awesome. And he was an even better guy. So it really sucks.
It's a new piano.
Probably shouldn't.
Thank you for listening to That's That. Please remember to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you're listening. It'll help the podcast get out there to more Philip Seymour Hoffman lovers. We'll see you next time with an in-depth look into the 1994 romantic drama When a Man Loves a Woman, starring Meg Ryan and Andy Garcia, and of course featuring Philip Seymour Hoffman. This is clearly going to be a smaller role film for Philip Seymour Hoffman. I've never seen this movie. I don't know anything about it. But here is the IMDb logline for the film. The seemingly perfect relationship between a man and his wife is tested as a result of her alcoholism. Yikes. So the film can be seen for free on IMDb TV or on Hoopla Digital. I'll put links to both of those things in the show notes. There's some of those like lesser known streaming places where you can find films to watch for free these days. So I'll definitely link those in the show notes. My guest will be returning crowd favorite, Samantha Sweeting Davis. That's That is sponsored by One County Film, an independent film company telling stories with authentic characters and unique settings. You can rent our debut feature film Palace on Amazon, which again in the show notes. You can check us out on YouTube, where our pal Jose talks about Criterion films. We've got a blog where we talk about movies and filmmaking and all that kind of stuff. We're pretty cool, I promise. We do this podcast as well. That's That is produced by me, Timothy Mark Davis, edited by Ryan Arnst. Our show music was composed and edited by Jessica Ray Huber, and our graphic was designed by Drew Hannigan. You can connect with One County Film on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all at One County Film. You can connect with me on Twitter at Timothy Mark DAV, Timothy Mark Dav, and Instagram at Timothy Mark Davis. Kelly, where can you be found online? What do you want to plug? What can I put in the show notes? What projects do you have going on? Give us all the info that you want to give us.
Well, you can follow me on Instagram at kelly.ray.jordan and at the Jordans Create. We have a lot of things that are going to be in the works soon. So just follow us to stay tuned for that.
Awesome. And we'll put that stuff in the show notes. Kelly, before we leave, I need the guest to quote Adam Sandler from Punch Drunk Love in a line he says to Dean Trumbull, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And the line is, "I'd say that's that, Mattress Man."
I'd say that's that, Mattress Man.
That's that, everybody.